Wild's plays. What I was saying last week about Wild and sexuality and how far Wild's opposed to this kind of typing, this kind of limiting and judging of individuals, and instead, central to pretty much all of his writing, his methods, his doctrines, his theories, everything he says, is individualism. The right of the individual to develop themselves, free from pressures from society, free from expectations, duties, and all the rest. And how far sexuality is absolutely central to that. That if it's about self-realization, then there are very few things that are more central to you, arguably, than your sexuality. So another thing that fits in with this is Wild's ideas on performance. So centrally, Wild doesn't offer a model of the self as essential, as essentialist. In that sense, it's not about one fixed interior true self as a model of identity. Rather, he offers a very performative model of identity. As, for example, Gilbert says in The Critic as Artist, what people call insincerity is simply a method by which we can multiply our personalities. So to act, to perform, is not the opposite of your identity or your character or interior self. It's simply another manifestation of it, another means of realizing yourself. So similarly, in the picture of Dorian Gray, you get the following. Is insincerity such a terrible thing? I think not. It is merely the method by which we can multiply our personalities. Such, at any rate, was Dorian Gray's opinion. He used to wonder at the shallow psychology of those who conceive the ego in man as a thing simple, permanent, reliable, and of one essence. To him, man was a being with myriad lives and myriad sensations, a complex, multiform creature that bore within itself strange legacies of thought and passion, and whose very flesh was tainted with the monstrous maladies of the dead. In context in the novel, when you get the is insincerity such a terrible thing, I think not, that sounds very much like a narrative, an authorial voice, until the beginning of the next paragraph suddenly distances and gives you another voice who says, so at any rate, thought Dorian Gray. So that very kind of multiplicity that is contained, is being talked about, is being enacted in the text itself. There's a kind of multiplicity and splitting of voices and indefiniteness and uncertainty happening about who's speaking and how at that point. And this multiple and mobile self, this mutable performed self, makes performance a mode of self-realization. So that to perform is also to be. And you can be as multiple as your performances. You're not fixed and typed. It's one of the primary ways in which Wild undermines that idea of typing, that idea of fixing and finding a true self, because if all the selves you can be are equally valid and equally true, then which one is someone going to fix and judge you by? How are you meant to read interior from exterior in that sense? And this, a lot of self-realization in Wild's theories is this right to create the self. It goes all the way through to, you know, what I talked about in the first lecture about De Profundis and the art of biography and the biography of art, the self as a work of art that you yourself are free to mould and to interpret as you choose. So in one sense, what Wild's doing is rejecting this notion of truth and fixed identity. The one place where he does offer some version of a kind of natural self, an organically growing self, is in The Soul of Man and Socialism, where he envisions a utopian society in which there are no duties, no laws, no constraints upon the individual whatsoever, no property, no marriage, no family. You're absolutely free to develop as you choose. And then he talks about then the soul, the true soul of man, you would see. And it would grow organically like a tree grows. Now, that's the only point where you see this idea of the organic, in a sense, sort of freely developing, and almost in that image of something kind of organic, something single in some ways. But it's not realized anywhere outside of that utopian society. And instead, Wild spends a lot of time that, along with this idea of the freedom of self-creation, there's also another mode of performance he talks about, which in a sense is the socially enforced performance. Either, so many of his characters in a sense split into those who can control performance, who can play at performance, who can keep society at arm's length with their role-playing, their control, all the rest of it, and the others who are in a sense unconsciously performing. The individual who has imbibed social expectations and so on, and isn't even conscious of their kind of distortion of self into these roles. So, for example, Wilde talks about even worse than tyrannies are those societies in which authority is expressed through kindness and rewards, because people in that case are less conscious of the horrible pressure that is being put on them, and so go through their lives in a sort of coarse comfort, like petted animals, without ever realizing that they are probably thinking other people's thoughts, living by other people's standards, wearing practically what one may call other people's second-hand clothes, and never being themselves for a single moment. So what you have here are, in a sense, two kinds of performance. One, self-conscious, self-delighting, creative, artistic. The other, unconscious. An imbibing of social attitudes, social modes, social assumptions, essentially mimicking, and it's a distortion, a deletion of the self, an erasure of the self. Now, these ideas of performance have obvious relevance to Wilde's plays, which are in themselves very obviously performative and about performance in all sorts of intricate and self-conscious ways. Now, the other important thing to know about Wilde's plays, to think about as a kind of general context for them, are 19th century modes of performance. Now, one of the most influential, the sort of central Victorian modes of performance is melodrama. And melodrama, which you may just know as a sort of set of extravagant plots and the idea of stock types and all the rest of it, central to pretty much every melodrama plot is the idea of revelation. So melodramas are absolutely full of innocent people condemned for crimes and innocent people misjudged and villains who are hiding their villainy from everybody else on stage, even if they're revealing it to the audience. And melodramas don't necessarily end happily, but they do end with the revelation of truth and truth about character. So absolutely central to melodrama is the mode of revelation and recognition, public recognition of the truth. So the wrongly accused may die, you know, as before the curtain comes down, but their innocence will also be recognised. So that becomes a kind of central trope in melodrama. And it's so much so it gets almost religious significance in Peter Brooks, who's one of the main theorists around melodrama. So he writes in his book, The Melodramatic Imagination, "Nothing is spared because nothing is left unsaid. The characters stand on stage and utter the unspeakable, give voice to their deepest feelings, dramatize through their heightened and polarized words and gestures the whole of their relationship. Life tends in this fiction towards ever more concentrated and totally expressive gestures and statements." So that's the idea of the absolute inner revelation, everything expressed, even if expressed without language, through gesture. But think about the very fact that you can express inner truth through gesture suggests something so clearly legible that it doesn't even need, it's absolute kind of instinctive recognition of the truth. And melodrama is clearly still popular right through the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century. There's still huge blockbuster melodramas playing at this point. And Wilde's clearly in conversation with melodrama. So lots of those standard melodrama tropes and characters like the fallen woman, the innocent maiden seduced, the illegitimate son, all the rest of it. Those are, you can see in his plays where he's using those ideas of blackmail and the dark secret in the past being revealed and so on. So Wilde's very clearly in conversation with that. But notably, and Wilde has plenty of revelation in his plays, but notably they don't happen in the fourth act, in the last act. Revelations in Wilde's plays tend to happen in the first or second act. So if you see, you know, revelation about who Mrs. Erlynne is happens by the end of, you know, certainly within the first act you get the first bit, and by the second act she's you know, kind of, you know that she's Lady Windermere's mother before she goes to rescue her and so on. The last act is where it complicates further, where she isn't either simply the fallen woman, nor is she the delinquent mother who's now sacrificing herself. She's something beyond any of those roles and expectations. Similarly, in A Woman of No Importance, you know who Mrs. Arbuthnot is by the end of the second act. But who she is in the sense of the revelation of her past and so on, who she actually is, what lies under all those, what, how far that revelation is all of her or not, that's complicated by the rest of the play. So there's a sense in which Wilde structures work on revelation and then complication. It's complete opposite to the standard, what's meant to be the well-made play structure as described by Bernard Shaw. Which was situation, complication, scène à faire, the great scene to be made, and then denouement, unknotting. Wilde's plays don't unknot, they re-knot. They get more complicated in that sense of trying to pass judgment and so on. Now, in contrast to this, and this structure of revelation and judgment, and very often clear judgment of characters according to clear set social standards and orthodoxies, moral and social orthodoxies. That's pretty much the structure that you'll find at the heart of most of Wilde's contemporaries and the plays they're writing. So if you look at plays by Arthur Wing Pinero, Henry Arthur Jones, Sidney Grundy and so on, they're the really popular playwrights of the 1890s, they're all essentially working on that structure. Even though they're writing a new kind of within a new kind of naturalism or in farce and so on, there's pretty much always a clear judgment upon the characters and the need to conform with social orthodoxy. But a contrary line of influence and context would be Ibsen's plays. So in Ibsen, and Shaw describes Ibsen's plays as instead our situation, complication, scene-affaire, discussion. So when all the issues then, that's very Shaw version of it, because discussion is what his plays are about. So classically, one that absolutely fits with that description would be A Doll's House, where it goes through all the mechanism the well-made played with letters and blackmail and all the rest of it, and then comes to Nora Helmer saying, okay, you're not the man I thought you were, I'm not the woman I thought I was, let's sit down and talk. She actually literally says, sit down, we need to talk. And then that last act is discussion. But importantly, also in that act, she's started as her husband's songbird, as the little squirrel, protected from the outside world. And then as she discovers how morally complex the outside world is and that it would judge and indeed criminalize her for what she's done, she then turns around and casts off that role. She says, I spent my whole life being a doll in your doll's house, first in my father's dollhouse, now in yours. But now it's time for me to grow up. Now it's time for me to understand that. So it's a sort of casting off of roles. At the same time as what she becomes, who she now is unfixed by the play. So the play ends with her leaving the house and the door slamming behind her. It ends with who she might become, with this possibility that the miracle of miracles will happen and she and her husband will have a real marriage based on genuine knowledge of each other. But that's held off in the distance. So in that sense, again, she's not fixed. Ibsen writes characters that are in conversation with social expectations, characters who are absolutely molded by and influenced by social issues, by contemporary morality and so on. In many ways, he's interested in this kind of post-Darwinist idea of adaptation to environment and the pressures of environment upon the development of the individual. So you can see how close that is to what Wilde's talking about in this idea of being molded by your society, the pressures of society upon you. And in that sense, part of what Wilde's doing is something that's much closer perhaps to Ibsen's idea of the multi-layered and unstable kind of characters he's writing, which are in conversation with social conventions. Except Wilde does them by, in a sense, putting his characters in conversation with melodramatic types. So you think you can judge them according to that, and then they start doing more complicated things. So very much, look, there's an idea, it's clear, it's very easy to pick out of Wilde's plays, the kind of the performers who are conscious and in control. Mrs. Erlynne, Mrs. Allenby in A Woman of No Importance, Mrs. Cheeveley in many ways in An Ideal Husband, Lord Illingworth, Lady Plimdale, Cecil Graham, there are loads of those kind of dandies who absolutely know what they're doing. They may or may not be successful in their schemes, but they can see the performance for what it is. Whereas Mrs. Arbuthnot in A Woman of No Importance, she's the fallen woman who by the end of the second act, you've got the whole thing about, you know, her shame and stop Gerald, he is your father and all of that kind of melodramatic language. But actually, when you get to Act 4, and she refuses to marry the man who's the father of her son, she, despite an offer of marriage from Lord Illingworth, she will not marry him because it's beneath her. But also the language in which that expressed, you get amazing when Wilde uses melodramatic language and uses that kind of register. It's often, it sounds more conventional in the texture of the language, and often the actual emotions and thoughts being expressed are anything but conventional. So in that speech, there's a wonderful speech in there of Mrs. Arbuthnot's in which she begs Gerald, she calls Gerald the little lamb that God sent me, and says, ends with, child of my shame, be still, child of my shame. But the whole speech is about how she's visited the sick and the poor and she's been to church and all the rest of it. But she doesn't give a toss about them. She only cares about Gerald, but he didn't want her love. So she had to do something with it. So it's absolutely, and she says, I would rather have had you than been innocent. She has never repented of her sin. In other words, there's a sense in which she's been performing the role of repentant woman, performing the role of the good, repentant Magdalene, but she realizes it kind of doesn't fit with what she's feeling. And whether that's a conscious performance or an unconscious performance, there's a sense in which she's imbibed the moral and sexual judgment of society upon her. And where she is under that is up to, in a sense, performance, how the actress performs that role, and your projection, as you're always doing as a theatrical audience, your projection from the exterior into the interior. So remember, unless you've got soliloquy as a kind of supposedly giving you the direct, unmediated voice of the inner self of a character, you are always judging from the outside. You're judging by language and action. And so Wilde uses that sense of not just the conscious performance of characters, but you're always negotiating from the outside. You're always imagining what's inside and the questions of what might be there. So in that sense, this indeterminacy of judgments, this challenge to the audience about how you think about the interior, is one of the crucial things as well, and ways in which he uses performance. Now, in my experience of students studying the plays, it's very hard often to get past surface. So style, not sincerity, is the vital thing, and manners before morals. There's a sense in which this glittering surface, the way in which so many of the characters talk in epigrams and paradoxes, and it's very kind of witty on the top, but it's quite hard to get hold of what it's doing underneath. So what I want to do now is go through An Ideal Husband to talk about what it's debating, what's at issue, at stake in it, and how it works. Not to resolve it, because I think it's in many ways the most difficult and unresolved of Wilde's plays. So, hands up, who's read An Ideal Husband? Okay, I'll give you a plot summary, okay? For those who haven't yet read it, here goes. So, Sir Robert Chiltern, who is the Under Secretary for Foreign Affairs in the British government, is holding a huge party in his very, very rich house, and there's an enormous tapestry at the top of the stairs, and they're greeting all the guests arriving, all aristocracy. And he's standing there with his wife, Lady Chiltern, and Mrs. Cheeveley arrives, friend of a friend, who is a woman hugely interested in politics and investment, and he's heard of her before. And she says to him, I would like you to declare your support for my Argentine canal scheme. And he says, can't possibly do so, it's a fraudulent scheme. And he goes, it's a swindle. And she goes, no, it's not a swindle, it's a daring investment. And he says, no, it's a swindle, let us call things by their proper name. And she says, I'll give you money if you back the scheme. And he says, you've forgotten, you're speaking to an English gentleman. And she says, I've not forgotten that I'm speaking to a man who sold a cabinet secret for money, and that was the beginning of his wealth and position. And I have the letter you wrote to Baron Arnheim that sold that secret. I will disgrace you unless you back my scheme. And he does humming and hawing and says, okay, I'll back the scheme. But then when he talks to his extremely moral wife later, and he says, oh, I'm going to back the scheme. And she says, no, it's immoral, it's wrong. And you are above such things. You are noble, you are always true. And he says, no, it's terribly complicated, it's politics, dear. Politics, very, very complicated things. You know, she says, but it's about doing right. She says, oh, that's in private, you know, it's public, very different matter. She goes, no, what is right in private is also right in public, etc. And she gets him to write a letter to Mrs. Cheeveley saying he won't back the scheme. And at the same time, at the same party, Lord Goring, a dandy about town, finds a brooch, a snake-headed brooch. And while chatting to Mabel Chiltern, who is Sir Robert Chiltern's younger sister, and puts it into his wallet and says, don't tell anyone I found it. That's act one. Act two, Sir Robert turns to Lord Goring and tells him about what's happened and that he's been blackmailed and asks for help and says, does he know of any scandal that he can bring down Mrs. Cheeveley through? And Lord Goring says, no, I can't. She's the kind of woman who just carries off any scandal. She's untouchable, but I will try. And there's a kind of conversation between them in which Lord Goring says, how could you have done this? And Sir Robert defends himself as having simply been ambitious and grasped power as he needed to. And then Mrs. Cheeveley arrives to visit. And Mrs. Cheeveley, Lady Chiltern, is very contemptuous of her. She was a thief at school, and shows her the door. And Mrs. Cheeveley turns around and says, don't be superior with me. This house was built on this, the secret of your husband's success was a scandal, was a lie. He sold, it was insider dealing that your house is built on. And Lady Chiltern is hugely shocked and goes to her husband and says, is this true? Tell me it's not true. And he says, yes, it's true, and you've ruined my career, because I would have bought back my past had it not been for you, woman. And it ends with her sobbing on the sofa. And Mrs. Cheeveley says she'd first come to ask about a brooch she'd lost. Says, I didn't come to ruin anything at all. I entirely came here because I was asking about a brooch. Next scene, it gets even more complicated. It's in Lord Goring's rooms in London. And Gertrude Chiltern has written him a letter. He offered help, knowing that there's a kind of problems coming. And Gertrude Chiltern has written him a letter saying, I need you, I want you, I'm coming to you, Gertrude. So he's expecting Gertrude Chiltern to arrive, and then his father arrives. This is about 10 o'clock at night, and then his father arrives. So he says to his butler, Phipps, if Lady Chiltern arrives, there's a lady who's going to arrive, and when this lady arrives, can you not let my father know, and so on, but show her into the library. So he talks to Lord Caversham, his father, and then not Lady Chiltern, but Mrs. Cheeveley arrives and is shown into the library. And then Lord Caversham leaves, and the butler tells him that Mrs. Cheeveley, that a lady is in his library. He thinks it's Lady Chiltern. And then Sir Robert Chiltern arrives and says, what am I going to do now? My wife knows all. And Sir Robert and Lord Goring talks to him about it'll be okay and trust her and she loves you and all the rest of it. And then there's a noise in the other room. And then Sir Robert goes and looks through the door and sees Mrs. Cheeveley there. And then denounces his friend Lord Goring for having supposedly been in league with this woman who's blackmailing him. At which point Lord Goring, thinking that it's Lady Chiltern, Sir Robert's wife, says, no, there's nothing wrong, nothing immoral. Do not think anything against this woman. She is utterly good and utterly pure. And Sir Robert storms out, and then Mrs. Cheeveley comes out the library with a big grin on her face, and he's totally shocked by that. And she then says, okay, I'll do you a deal. I will swap you Sir Robert's letter, I'll let him off the blackmail, in return for you marrying me. I fancy being married again. I've done it lots of times, and it's very entertaining. And he says, no, I'm not into self-sacrifice. It's terribly bad, especially for the people you're sacrificing yourself for. And there's a whole conversation between her, and she defends herself from having gone to the house to ruin the Chilterns' marriage by saying, no, I went there for a brooch that I'd lost. And Lord Goring takes out the brooch he found in first act and said, is it this brooch? And she says, oh, yes, how clever of you. How do you go? And then he says, oh, no, it's not a brooch, it's a bracelet, and clasps it onto her wrist. At which point he then says, it's a bracelet, and I gave it to my cousin, and it was then stolen. And I'm about to have you arrested as a thief. And she goes, oh, just take it off. And I'll show this. Nothing, you can't accuse me. And then she can't get it off. It's got a hidden catch. So the brooch turns into a bracelet and you can't get it off your wrist. And as she's panicking, Lord Goring says, okay, give me Sir Robert's letter and I will take it off you. Otherwise, you're going to the police. And she finally gives in and gives him the letter and he burns it. And then he releases the bracelet. And just then she says, oh, I feel terribly faint. Can you get me a glass of water? And as he's getting a glass of water, she's spotted Lady Chiltern's letter. I want you, I need you, I'm coming to you. And she nicks that. And she says, naha, I'm such a friend of Lady Chiltern that I'm going to show her husband that his wife is having an affair. And she walks out the room with the letter. So, final act. Sir Robert, am I doing all right on this? Last act, Sir Robert says, Lord Goring tells Sir Robert that Lady Chiltern, that he has got hold of the letter and burnt it, and that Sir Robert is now safe. And Lady Chiltern is hugely relieved. But Lord Goring also says, but Mrs. Cheeveley stole the letter. and you must tell your husband the truth. And Lady Chiltern says, I can't tell my husband I was at your rooms at night on my own. I can't possibly. He says, no, you should tell your husband the truth. She goes, I can't. He says, okay. And in the meanwhile, Sir Robert Chiltern, not knowing about his being off the hook and the letter being got, has given a speech in the House, in the House of Parliament, condemning the Argentine Canal scheme. And on the basis of this, the great reports in the Times about his nobility and how he's a much better politician and much higher moral standards than these foreign politicians and all the rest of it. And then you get Sir Robert meets Lady Chiltern and comes in with a letter in his hand, the letter that had been Mrs. Cheveley had sent. But it's been taken out the envelope by his secretary. So all he reads is, I need you, I want you, I'm coming to you, Gertrude. And he says, is it true? Have you forgiven me? And she goes, yes, absolutely. Totally forgive me. Lovely darling. And they're reconciled. And then Lord Caversham comes in, who's from the House of Lords, and says, the Prime Minister is offering, on the basis of this great speech and everything else, is offering Sir Robert a seat in the Cabinet. And Sir Robert's terribly excited until he looks at his wife, and then he goes, I'm not taking it. I resign. And Lady Chiltern approves. At which point Lord Goring goes aside with, he's in the meanwhile proposed to Mabel Chiltern, Sir Robert's younger sister. And Lord Goring takes Lady Chiltern aside and says, don't do this. Don't destroy Sir Robert's love for you. Don't destroy his ambition. It's so important to him, and your marriage will be destroyed if you prevent him following through with this. And he says, it's not German philosophy and all the rest of it that's the heart of things, it's love. And a woman's duty is to forgive her husband, and many other things. And a man's life is of more value than a woman's. So her job was given, at which point she then, when her husband comes back in, rips up the letter of resignation, and he's delighted because he can go into the Cabinet. At which point he turns to his friend Lord Goring and says, is there anything I can do for you? And Lord Goring says, yes, you could let me marry your sister. And he goes, and Sir Robert says, oh no, not that. I can't let you marry her because you're having an affair with Mrs. Cheveley, and it would be utterly unfair on my sisters to marry a man who's having an affair with somebody else. At which point, Lady Chiltern tells the truth and says, that letter was addressed to him, not to you. I was the woman he was expecting. He wasn't having an affair with Mrs. Cheveley at all. And I'm terribly sorry, and I'm not having an affair with him myself. And he says, how could you not have trusted me? You are pure and always will be pure. And you are the pure image of all good things, and sin could never touch you. At which point, Sir Robert gets to have a seat in the Cabinet with his wife alongside, and Lord Goring gets to marry Mabel Chiltern. Ta-da! So, what you have there is a fantastic mix of all sorts of different dramatic modes. So you've got the play of politics and intrigue, and it's set right in the heart of the British government. You've got the play of high-class society and intrigue over money and so on, and marriage and love and all the rest of it. You've got blackmail. You've got glimpse into the corridors of power. You've also got all of Wilde's verbal wit. So reviews at the time tended to end with a whole list of epigrams and paradoxes and witty sayings from the play as a kind of like a take-home goodie bag that you could use in parties yourself after that. There are discussions of public morality. There are discussions of the role of women. There's lots on the nature of men's and women's love in the play, and lots on the different roles, the division of the spheres between men and women. Now, this kind of multiplicity was clearly picked up on by reviewers at the time. So, for example, a reviewer in Like a Joko said, the story, which was presumably adapted from the Family Herald, that's what Wilde said of A Woman of No Importance, is so full of high-class virtue and vice that the gallery is kept in a state of subdued enthusiasm, while the stalls are puzzling over the paradoxes. But it requires a pit to appreciate the depth of the dramatic talent, and a pit, unfortunately, is wanting at the Haymarket Theatre. If some accomplished dramatist, Mr. G.R. Sims, for instance, he was one of the most famous melodramatist at the time, would only straighten out Mr. Wilde's English into robust intelligibility, an audience on the Surrey side might enjoy the familiar flavour of this genteel melodrama. Now, this play, so it's playing at the St. James's Theatre, it's playing at the kind of in the heart of the West End, in one of the most aristocratic kind of venues, the higher class venues. And this commentator is saying it could be playing on the other side of the river, in other words, in the cheap, big melodrama houses. So there's a sense in which this is a play of multi-layers, as far as they're concerned. And there's a whole issue here about who's Wilde writing for. What's the audience? That thing I said about his using this kind of unstable genre, and that emphasis in so many of his works about what a work means is about who it's written for and how it's read. So in some ways, that idea of the multiplicity of readers producing a kind of instability, there's a question of who the play's written for. Now, Wilde, in interviews, so just as in De Profundis, he talks about, I made the drama as personal as the lyric and the sonnet. So this idea that the theatre is the most public form out there, and Wilde consistently talks about it as though it's a very, very personal thing. So in an interview before the play opened, Wilde was interviewed and was asked by the journalist, "What is your feeling towards your audiences, towards the public?" And Wilde says, "Which public? There are as many publics as there are personalities." Journalist tries again, "Are you nervous on the night that you are producing a new play?" "Oh no, I am exquisitely indifferent. My nervousness ends at the last dress rehearsal. I know then what effect my new play, as presented upon the stage, has produced upon me. My interest in the play ends there, and I feel curiously envious of the public. They have such wonderful, fresh emotions in store for them." I laughed, but Mr. Wilde rebuked me with a look of surprise. "It is the public, not the play, that I desire to make a success," he said. And he continues, "We shall never have a real drama in England until it is recognised that the play is as personal and individual a form of self-expression as a poem or a picture." So what you've got again there is this idea of not just the public, but many publics, that multiplicity and uncertainty of interpretation. And also this idea of the play as something for himself. So he's not offering it with a single meaning for everybody in any sense. So the reviews of their first performance of An Ideal Husband reveal a kind of moral confusion among critics, a huge uncertainty about what kind of implication they were meant to read out of the play. So, for example, in Pick Me Up, the critic commented, "Lady Chiltern is depressingly good all the time, good enough to drive an ordinary husband to drink from a sheer monopoly of the cardinal virtues. I shall always think kindly of a great public man in the future if I hear he is suddenly found to have been all along a masterpiece of moral error. I shall put his drawbacks down to the fact that he must have an abnormally good wife." Or by contrast, A.B. Walkley in The Speaker inveighed against Sir Robert Chiltern as basically a sordid rogue, somebody whose morality changed according to the circumstances and what suited him, and said the moral of the play seems to be that the great thing is not to be found out. Indeed, the whole play is designed to fill us with joy over the escape of a sinner from the penalty of his sin through a trick with a diamond bracelet. So he feels there's no kind of moral resolution offered by this play whatsoever. I won't read the whole of Bernard Shaw's review of An Ideal Husband, but it's a wonderful one. Do read it through in detail. What Shaw does is say that Wilde is our only thorough playwright, and playwright in the sense that he plays with everything, with wit, with philosophy, with drama, with actors and audience, with the whole theatre. And the Englishman can't cope with this because English don't play at anything. They're serious about everything, including sport and games. Whereas Wilde, as an Irishman, plays with everything, even with things that matter hugely to him. So as a result of which, the Englishman is shocked at the dangers of the foundations of society when seriousness is publicly laughed at. And to complete the oddity of the situation, Mr. Wilde, touching what he himself reverences, is absolutely the most sentimental dramatist of the day. Shaw continues, "It is useless to describe a play which has no thesis, which is in the purest integrity a play and nothing else. The six worst epigrams are mere alms handed with a kind smile to the average suburban playgoer. The three best remain secrets between Mr. Wilde and a few choice spirits. The modern note is struck in Sir Robert Chiltern's assertion of the individuality and courage of his wrongdoing, as against the mechanical stupidity of his stupidly good wife, and in his bitter criticism of a love that is only the reward of merit. It is from the philosophy on which this scene is based that the most pregnant epigrams in the play have been condensed. Indeed, this is the only philosophy that has ever produced epigrams." So these are the moral problems inherent in the play. It's structured around a criminal and sympathy with a criminal, somebody who sold a cabinet secret for money, who's a kind of insider dealing as a foundation of his wealth. Now, Sir Robert Chiltern explicitly does not repent of his crime. He says, "What the century values is wealth, Without wealth, you can't do anything. And he says, I fought the century with its own weapons and won. He then says, oh, I gave lots of money to charity, sort of make up for it and all the rest of it. Now, he isn't punished within the play, but actually rewarded with a seat in the heart of government. So the person whose sin is revealed, whose duplicity, and he's ready, remember, not just that he sold his country once for money, but he's ready to do it a second time to stave off scandal. So there's no sense at the beginning, without the influence of his wife and so on, that he would have changed from that. Then you have all the way through this kind of playing with this idea of criminality. So if you've got Sir Robert as the one kind of criminal, he's paralleled actually, and he's the one who's rewarded with the seat in the cabinet, he's paralleled with the villainess of the play. So Mrs. Cheveley first says of the Argentine Canal scheme, when Sir Robert calls it a swindle, let us call things by the proper name. She then, when she announces that she knows he first sold his cabinet secret for money, he says, oh, no, it's a very complicated transaction. She says, it was a swindle. Let us call things by their proper name. So there's a deliberate, she's paralleling, and she carries on doing it, paralleling the two of them throughout the play, that she knows what he's like because they are two of a kind, she keeps asserting. So there's a very interesting kind of paralleling. What's a play where the hero and the villain or villainess are in a sense being paralleled throughout the play. One gets rewarded, the other gets shown the door. Though importantly, Mrs. Cheveley, she doesn't get what she wants, but she doesn't get shown up or anything else. There's no kind of unmasking of her going on in that sense. She leaves scot-free in many ways. Against this idea of the villain and corruption and so on, against that you have Lord Goring. He's another of Wilde's dandy heroes, so very like Lord Illingworth and Lord Darlington and Lord Henry Wotton, except he becomes a force for, he sort of sympathises with everybody and tries to bring everything together. Now, he offers a kind of dandy-esque philosophy of being trivial and idle and surface and only worrying about what your buttonhole is and all the rest of it. And he criticises Sir Robert Chilton for the shallowness of this desire for money and wealth. He calls that worship of wealth a thoroughly shallow creed. But, as the play also emphasises, Lord Goring is born, as Sir Robert points out, is born with birth, aristocratic status, and money, and has never known ambition. In other words, it's very easy to have a philosophy like that if, in a society which worships wealth and is not a meritocracy, easy for you to think like that. He's one of the privileged. So his condemnation of Sir Robert's values is coming from someone who's mired in this society where wealth is, by the end of the play, absolutely inherently connected with corruption, or at the very least complacency and not wanting to allow in anybody else who isn't one of the club. Then you have the issue of idealising within the play. So Lady Chilton fits with Hester Worsley and A Woman of No Importance, fits with Lady Windermere and Lady Windermere's Fan, as a woman who has hard and fast rules, a Puritan who idealises and condemns. And she has to learn to forgive, to accept flaws in the human being. And in a sense, that fits very closely with what the society is guilty of. So Sir Robert Chilton, Mrs. Cheveley explicitly says to him, ideally, you'd be able to confess your errors and all the rest of it. But the way that society works is this idea that all of us are, that everybody else is pure and good, you scapegoat the individual. You need scandals as a kind of general whitewashing of everybody else. So that there is no way you would be forgiven this error. Instead, it would be another of those scandals that go, look at him, he's corrupt, the rest of us aren't. So there's a huge kind of idealising in society, which is what makes it opens up Sir Robert Chilton to blackmail and makes his confession impossible, public confession and forgiveness. So with this idea, what do we get with Lady Chilton? All this thing about who characters are by the end of the play. Lady Chilton has accepted her husband's error and allowed him a space in the cabinet at the end, to accept that seat in the cabinet. But is that a sense in which she simply is scared of losing his love and is allowing corruption in the heart of government? Or is she a moralising force still standing next to him, making sure he doesn't do that again? Play doesn't answer that at all. You could indicate it in performance. You could have her as a very strong figure standing side by side with him, or you can have her body language says a huge amount. You can have her, in a sense, defeated and sidelined with him stepping forward and taking control. It can be a very cynical ending, or a much more optimistic ending, purely according to how you're playing the relationship between those two. The script does not answer it, very importantly. And again, another theme that plays all the way through the play is the role of women in politics. So Sir Robert Chiltern, when he's trying to justify and all the rest of it, his backing of the Argentine Canal scheme, does a whole, politics is terribly complicated, you can't understand it, dear. Now, you've also got, at the beginning of the play, a kind of separation of spheres. So that basic idea of the man's sphere and the woman's sphere, the domestic sphere versus the public sphere. Also, the idea that politics is this kind of rough and tumble, much more cynical world, as against the idea that women belong to the domestic and the much more idealised world. Now, in one sense, Lady Chiltern is refusing that kind of division at the beginning. So she's a political force. She's a member of the Women's Liberal Federation. And there's a point when she comes in Act Two, she's just come back from a meeting of the WLF, in which they have discussed factory acts, the 8 hours bill, and prison reform. Now, those are exactly the kind of humanitarian, much more compassionate politics that were coming in at that point. So the 8 hours Act is about limiting factory hours and factory acts. Those are about things like children's working hours and things like that. So in a sense, she's a humanizing force in politics. She's about, and a lot of the argument of the suffragists and so on for women's involvement in politics is that women know about children, know about the vulnerable and all the rest of it, and therefore ought to be able to allow into politics to speak for them. So in that sense, the play, these are exactly the kind of things that Wilde's arguing for after he's been to prison. There's exact things like more humane treatment of children in prison. Now, Sir Robert is trying to keep his wife out of public life, and importantly, a stage direction that describes him when he first arrives is the firmly chiselled mouth and chin contrast strikingly with a romantic expression in the deep-set eyes. The variance is suggestive of an almost complete separation of passion and intellect, as though thought and emotion were each isolated in its own sphere through some violence of willpower. Now, there seems to be a separation between feeling and reason, between passion and intellect. When Lord Goring persuades Lady Chiltern to step aside and not interfere in her husband's life and ambitions, his speech begins, "A man's life is of more value than a woman's. It has larger issues, wider scope, greater ambition. A woman's life revolves in curves of emotion. It is upon lines of intellect that a man's life progresses." In other words, that end of the play seems to reassert a division between intellect and passion, between reason and feeling, which is exactly what led to the problem with Sir Robert Chiltern to start with. So is the play validating or undermining that kind of split? Is it supporting separate spheres? Is it talking about the necessary exclusion of women from public life because they're too moralistic and too idealising? Or is it talking about the need for them as a moralising force? Your decision. There are a sense in which so many of the speeches in the play come in collision with each other. No two speeches line up. So there's a long speech from Sir Robert when he accuses his wife of having ruined his life that says, "We men love forever, we love faults and all, whereas you women idealise and your love is dependent on our being good." All very well, but for the fact at the end of the play, the one who's doing the idealising is Sir Robert Chiltern, who has a great speech calling his wife the pure image of all good things and sin can never touch you. Sounds pretty idealising to me. Whereas it's Lady Chiltern who has to forgive her husband or she'll lose his love. In other words, that bit of the play plays completely against the speech that's happening earlier in the play. So what is the difference between men and women's loves? You've got very, very different speeches. No two speeches, no set of speeches in the play combined to create a truth. It's deliberately multivocal and unstable in a way that, think about Wilde's essays and the way that he uses that kind of dialogue form there. A sense in which there are all sorts of conversations and cross lines happening through the play. Now, I want to play you just the one crucial scene, which is between Sir Robert Chiltern and Lord Goring. It's the kind of confession scene.
"You should have told your wife the whole thing. No man should have a secret from his own wife. She invariably finds it out. Women have a wonderful instinct about things. They can discover anything. Except the obvious. It would have meant a lifelong separation between them. I should have lost the love of the only woman in the world I wish it. You have turned from me in horror and in contempt.
But Lady Chiltern is perfect as all that."
"Yes, my wife's as perfect as all that.
Not a pity. If what you're doing is true, I'd like to have a serious talk about life with him, sir. It would be quite useless. Well, I'm bound to say I think you would have told him years ago.
When? When we were engaged? Do you think you'd have married me if you'd known I'd done a thing which I suppose most men would call shameful and dishonorable?
Yes, most men would call it ugly names, there's no doubt about that.
Whom did I wrong by what I did? No one.
Except yourself, Holmes.
Do you think it fair that a man's whole career should be ruined for a fault done in his boyhood almost? I was 22 at the time. I had the double misfortune of being well-born and poor. Two unforgivable things nowadays. Is it fair that the folly of one's youth should wreck a life like mine? Is it fair, Arthur?
Life is never fair, Arthur.
Perhaps it's a good thing for most of us that it's not. Every man of ambition has to fight his century with his own weapons. Of this century worships his wealth. The god of this century is wealth. To succeed, one must have wealth. At all costs, one must have wealth.
You underrate yourself, Robert. Believe me, without wealth, you would have succeeded just as well.
When I was old, perhaps. When I was tired, worn out, disappointed. I wanted my success when I was young. I couldn't wait.
Robert, how could you have sold yourself for money?
I did not sell myself for money. I bought success at a great price, that's all.
Yes, you certainly paid a great price for it. What price made you think of doing such a thing?
Bernardo. That scoundrel.
No. He was a man of the most subtle and refined intellect.
A man of charm, culture, and distinction. I prefer a gentlemanly fool any day. There's more to resent for stupidity than people imagine. Personally, I have a great admiration for stupidity.
Sort of inner feeling, I suppose.
But how did he do it? Tell me the whole thing.
One evening after dinner at Lord Radley's, the man began talking about success in modern life as something one could reduce to an absolutely definite science. Then with that wonderfully fascinating, quiet voice of his, he expounded to us the most terrible of all philosophies, the philosophy of power. Preached to us the most marvelous of all gospels, the gospel of gold. I think he saw the effect he produced on me, but some days later he wrote to us and began to see him. I remember so well how a strange smile on his pale, curved lips. He led me to his wonderful picture gallery, showed me his tapestries, his enamels, his jewels, his car boundaries, and made me wonder at the Londonness of the luxury in which he lived. Then he told me that luxury was nothing but a background, a painted scene in a play, and a power. Power over other men. Power over the world was the one thing that really mattered. The one supreme pleasure worth having. The one joy one never tired of. And that in this century, only the rich possess it. A thoroughly shallow creed.
I didn't think so then, I don't think so now. Well.
So what you've got there, that speech, Mr. Robert, you've got that contrast between a kind of lounging, complacent, however charming Lord Goring, and Sir Robert Chiltern is in one sense the kind of the serious one, the one who's committed, who's ready to challenge and analyse this side differently and played out against the Houses of Parliament. Remember, this is the heart of British government. Now, you could try trying to understand the play by linking Sir Robert Chiltern with all those criminal heroes that Wilde has. The Canterville Ghost, the criminals, the inmates in Ballad of Reading Jail, Lord Arthur Savile in Lord Arthur Savile's Crime, and so on. There are lots of those defences, and the defence of the criminal in The Soul of Man under Socialism. So you've got Wilde launching an attack on money worship in The Soul of Man under Socialism, and the following critique where he says, "Disobedience in the eyes of anyone who has read history is man's original virtue. It is through disobedience that progress has been made, through disobedience and through rebellion. Sometimes the poor are praised for being thrifty, but to recommend thrift to the poor is both grotesque and insulting. Man should not be ready to show that he can live like a badly fed animal. He should decline to live like that and should either steal or go on the rates, which is considered by many to be a form of stealing, as by our current Tory government. As for begging, it is safer to beg than to take, but it is finer to take than to beg. No, a poor man who is ungrateful, unthrifty, discontented and rebellious is probably a real personality and has much in him. He is at any rate a healthy protest. I can quite understand a man accepting laws that protect private property and admit of its accumulation as long as he himself is able to, under those conditions, to realise some form of beautiful and intellectual life. But it is almost incredible to me how a man whose life is marred and made hideous by such laws can possibly acquiesce in their continuance." So you could try and type Sir Robert Chiltern as a rebel in that form. a rebel against a society of corruption and control through money. But the fact is, he kind of joins the gang. So if that is a society that is guilty of using wealth and desiring power over others, which is exactly what Solomon and socialism condemns as a creed, Sir Robert Chilton both critiques it and joins the gang. And notably, at the end of the play, the idealizing that's happening in politics is only shored up by his appointment to the cabinet. So he's got this reputation as a more noble and more moral and less lax politician than everybody else, and he's now got a seat in the cabinet, which only supports that, perpetuates the rottenness of the system that's been displayed in the play. In that sense, it goes very closely alongside, say, Bernard Shaw's Widower's Houses on the kind of corruption of late 19th century capitalism and the perpetuation of the system there. So in that sense, it's a play. Also, think about the play's reflection of the audience. So in its first performance and very early performances, cabinet ministers attended, the PM attended, Lord Rothschild, head of Rothschild banking and all the rest of it, attended. That kind of wealth and richness in the stalls, in the boxes and all the rest of it, is exactly what's being portrayed and reflected on stage and linked into corruption and money. So in another set, and there's no purging. Everybody is involved in that different ways. It asks about where the money is. And the whole system that's being looked at within the play, this idea of the scapegoating of the individual and the way the system works. Sir Robert Chilton is Under Secretary for Foreign Affairs. Now, the Under Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Sir Charles Dilke, who was a reforming politician that Wilde had exchanged letters with and admirer of, was brought down by a divorce scandal and was thrown out. And his career completely ruined. Charles Stewart Parnell, who was the leader of the Irish Party and the main campaigner for Irish Home Rule, was similarly brought down by a divorce case and a scandal, where everybody knew what was really happening, but there was this kind of performance of scandal and horror at it, and a performance of moral horror. Just as Wilde himself, the prescience in some ways of the structure that's being offered in An Ideal Husband. So in that sense, it's a play that's both high melodrama and in another sense, quite acute and cutting and almost prescient political analysis. So you can have a look at the kind of performance that's about money and wealth and aristocracy and the performance of morality that perpetuates society in that play. Performance as a kind of social corruption, performance as Lady Chilton imbibing those roles. I just want to end on a much more optimistic, and it's Wilde refuses to say who Sir Robert Chilton really is. So there are two film versions, this Alex Corder one and an Oliver Parker film version from, can't remember, like just at the end of the 20th century. And in both of them, you get a speech, you get an extra scene added in which Sir Robert Chilton gives a speech in the House in which he affirms his real, he stands up and says, England has got a dangerous past of wanting money and power, but a new era is beginning, and it's shown by our refusing the Argentine Canal scheme. And it's all about how he really is a good man and willing to risk everything. But the play doesn't give that. There's no answer to who he is. Now, the importance of being earnest is in many ways the absolute quantum opposite to that. The importance of being earnest I want to end on as the play that is about self-conscious performance. That is a play in which every character, it's a kind of utopian anarchy. Every character gets to create and perform themselves. So it's anything but an ideal society in other ways. It's ruled over by Lady Bracknell, who only cares about money and birth. She's the one who famously and wonderfully responds to the news that Jack's an orphan. By to lose one parent might be considered a misfortune, but to lose two looks like carelessness. So it's kind of the ultimate in callousness. She represents this society. It's a kind of matriarchy of absolute power and completely callous. And despite that, every character spends the entire time creating their own fantasies, which then by the end of the play have miraculously come true. So Cecily's diary and Jack as Ernest and Algy having a brother and all the rest of it all miraculously come true. So reality in that play distorts around their performances. There's no difference between performance and truth. One becomes the other in it. And there's no sense in which the marriages at the end of the play are fixing these characters into truth and good behaviour. So Jack turns to Gwendolyn at the end of the play and says, Gwendolyn, it is a terrible thing for a man to find out suddenly that all his life he has been speaking nothing but the truth. Can you forgive me? And Gwendolyn says, I can, for I feel you are sure to change. In other words, you're not going to carry on with any of this truth nonsense from now on. And there's also, it's a wonderful play that when it comes to sexual roles and gender roles, they're completely, there's a wonderful kind of play within that play of gender roles and all the rest of it. So it's the women who effectively do the proposing in the play. It's the women who are absolutely in command. Whereas Algy, for example, arrives to stay for a week with three large suitcases, two hat boxes, and a luncheon basket. So he's got about 18 changes of costumes and lots of hats in there. And they're very, in that sense, the men are purely decorative in that play. So Lady Bracknell, when she interviews Jack for his eligibility, is delighted to hear that he smokes, because there are too many idle young men in London as it is, and a man needs an occupation of some kind. She's also delighted that he's ignorant, because ignorance is like a delicate exotic bloom. Touch it, fruit, touch it, and the bloom is gone. So she would much prefer he was ignorant, purely decorative, and idle. That's all a man needs to be in this play. And in that sense, so it's together with that. And again, remember, it's a play in which all those kind of gay puns that are sewn into the text. It's a play that's multiple in all sorts of ways, and whilst absolutely playing with his audience. So all that stuff about silver cigarette cases, as turned up in the trials, the exchange of silver cigarette cases was one of those kind of exchange between Wilde and his various lovers. Just as the whole thing about the importance of being earnest, which is a pun on urinist. Urinist being one of the absolute kind of just coined very, very recently terms for the new type of the homosexual. So there's a kind of play on that. I have to say the supposed pun on bunburying, the word buns for buttocks comes into coinage in the 1960s in America. But it's also wonderfully Wildean that I think he'd love the fact that this other pun has kind of come into existence in the play. So it's a fantastic play in which everybody is self-creating, in which the language itself twists round. So language doesn't fix things. It plays games just the same way. So when Jack finds out, is told by Cecily, rushes up and says, "You'll never guess who's coming to tea. Your brother Ernest." And Jack says, "I haven't got a brother." And Cecily says, and you think, uh-oh, he's spoken the truth. At which point Cecily says, "Oh, don't say that. Whatever he's done, he's still your brother." In other words, it's kind of whatever that each expression turns around to become what it needs to be. There's this kind of mutual game that all the characters play of absolutely accepting the truths that each other delivers. So in that sense, it's wonderfully anarchic. There are no rules, there are no meanings that are fixed in that play. Just like Canon Chasuble's sermon on the meaning of the manor in the wilderness, which can be performed at, he then has a wonderful list of everything from christenings to funerals and harvest festivals and all the rest of it. The same speech serves all purposes because it's infinitely mutable. And this is that's what you get in that play. It's that idea of the command of your own performance, where performance becomes ultimately liberating. It's a farce in which all these truths come out and nobody's fixed by those truths, in which sins are revealed and nobody gets punished for them, they get rewarded for them. There's no fixing happening in there. And poor old Lady Bracknell, who wishes to do nothing but pass judgment upon people, is absolutely impotent in trying to punish anybody. In that sense, it's Wilde's gayest text in all sorts of ways, in every meaning of that word. It's a playful, performative, unfixed text that's this wonderful celebration of gender freedom, sexual freedom, absolute anarchic freedom to create yourself. And it's that kind of performance that is, in one sense, running problematically through all Wilde's other plays, up against all this power of society. But in The Importance of Being Earnest, he lets it loose. And it's there that I want to end, with that fantastic power of performance. I was tempted to end. The last quote I've given you on the handout is Wilde's speech at the final curtain of Lady Windermere's Fan. It's where he turned to the audience. He came up on stage after Lady Windermere's Fan and said to the audience, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have enjoyed this evening immensely. The actors have given us a charming rendering of a delightful play, and your appreciation has been most intelligent. I congratulate you on the great success of your performance, which persuades me that you think almost as highly of the play as I do myself." So it's that Wilde turning the performance, is the audience performing as much as the play is performing. So I'd like to end by saying thank you enormously for your appreciation, and that your appreciation has been most intelligent. Thank you.